The Stars and Stripes fly in Havana again. Hello and welcome to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. America's Cuban embassy officially is open again today, 54 years after it closed. Diplomatic relations have been normalized, but relations are far from normal. Human rights abuses, confiscated properties, and the U.S. trade embargo remain hallmarks of the dialogue still ongoing between the two countries. And how are the new relations between the U.S. and Cuba affecting America's relationship with the rest of the Caribbean and the rest of Latin America? Plus, will Broward County bow to the demands of Uber for fewer regulations of ride-sharing services? We'll talk about the politics of the sharing economy. And Flaca, the Chinese-imported drug, finds users and causes trouble here in South Florida. All ahead on the Florida Roundup next. Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Applause as the American flag flies in Havana at the U.S. Embassy today. With the United States Army Brass Quintet playing this morning, the national anthem, Old Glory, was hoisted up the flagpole on the grounds of the embassy in Havana overlooking the Florida Straits. It was 54 years ago that James Tracy, Larry Morris, and Mike East were on duty as U.S. Marines lowering the flag when President Eisenhower broke off diplomatic relations. The three were at the ceremony today in Cuba. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry also there, officially reopening that embassy in Havana. It comes 8 months after President Obama began efforts to normalize relations, a half century since relations were broken off, and 70 years since a sitting U.S. Secretary of State stepped onto Cuban soil.
The establishment of normal diplomatic relations is not something that one government does as a favor to another. It is something that two countries do together when the citizens of both will benefit.
Today's flag-raising ceremony was not without criticism, though, of the event itself. Cuban dissidents, those who oppose the Castro regime, were not in attendance this morning. Earlier this week, Secretary Kerry explained to NBC's Jose Diaz-Balart why Cuban dissidents were not invited.
Because that is a government-to-government moment with very limited space, by the way, which is why we are having the reception later in the day in which we can have a cross-section of civil society, including some dissidents.
Now, critics, like several of South Florida's congressional delegation, pounced on that decision by the State Department and the Obama administration, saying it illustrates the administration's rush to reengage with Cuba, sidestepping bigger issues like human rights and the lack of political freedoms on the island. So what does a normal relationship between U.S. and Cuba look like now that the flag flies over Havana again at the American embassy? What does it look like for Americans and for Cubans and for Cuban Americans? What does it mean for your family here in South Florida? How about your business? And how does this evolving relationship change how America is seen elsewhere in the Caribbean and Latin America? Join the conversation here on the Florida Roundup at 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576 on the telephone, on social media, on Twitter at WLRN, and find our Facebook group on facebook.com/group/TheFloridaRoundup. Elvira Salazar from Mira TV is back with us here on the Florida Roundup, and Tim Padgett, our America's editor, joining us via Skype from Honduras. Maria, let me begin with you here in Miami. The optics of raising the flag 8 months after the reengagement effort was launched by the Obama administration, what does it mean in your sense for the Cuban Americans here in this community?
Hi, thank you for inviting me once again, and hi to everybody. It's a sweet and sour moment. It's as a friend of mine that I was just talking to on the phone told me, this is unreal. For other people, this is the only real thing that we can do. It starts the process. I think that clock starts ticking for the Cuban government. For the Cuban Americans in Miami, depends on who you talk to. The first wave, which my mom belongs to that first wave, or if you talk to the last wave, which are the balseros, mm-hmm. as you say it in Spanish, which are the rafters, the one that came 2-3 years ago, that have very strong ties to Cuba as well, where they still have the mom, the family. This is sort of an opening. For my mom, it's treason. for
on the part of America.
On the part of America, absolutely. 54 years, and we never expected, or we meaning that first wave, never expected that the American flag was going to go up again with Fidel and Raul in power. No one was going to be able to think that that was possible. But then at the same time, then the other side says, after 54 years of trying to do something, everything and nothing has really worked because the embargo was not really well implemented, you know, and then you have all the other different nuances to the whole story. This is the only thing that the Obama was able to do.
Secretary of State Kerry, in his remarks today in Havana, Tim Padgett said that the relations between the United States and Cuba have been, quote, suspended in the amber of Cold War politics. If that amber has melted away, what remains, and what about the near-term future? This has been a long-term game, very patient is what the administration has guided here. But in the near term, what are the next guideposts?
Well, what remains is a policy that a lot of people, and according to polls, about two-thirds of Americans, feel we should have been trying, you know, a generation ago. Because as Maria Elvira just pointed out, for 54 years, we had a policy in place of isolating this communist island, and it simply did not work in terms of, you know, dislodging the communist regime, but also just in terms of us being able to influence change there at all. And I think what remains now is a chance, at least this is the way the Obama administration is thinking, a chance to begin to effect reform in Cuba by having our foot in the door for once in more than half a century.
The foot's in the door. Diplomats are at work, Maria. They're able to travel in Cuba with notification, not with permission by the Cuban authorities. That's what the State Department has pointed to as one of their big wins in the negotiation process that led up to the Stars and Stripes being raised today.
Absolutely. But we have to understand that we're going to have a lot of American diplomats walking around from Santiago to Pinar del Rio. And you've had Canadians and you've had Italians and you've had other Americans also walking around. And, you know, Cubans are fascinated by the United States. That's why, I don't know if you know that the way that the Cubans in Cuba call the United States the Yuma. Mm-hmm. It's that's like going to heaven. So Yuma is heaven. So when they see a Yuma representative walking around the streets of Havana, everybody is like honey to the bees, right? The problem here is, or the challenge that the Obama administration has is, how much are we, meaning the United States government, going to really be able to influence changes there? Because, you know, the Cubans, meaning the Castro brothers, proved that they were very good at the business of power. They're excellent. 54 years without a glitch. So, obviously, and I am a firm believer, and this is my opinion, that Obama has good intentions. Now, are those intentions going to be translated into really political move or changes for the benefit of the Cuban people?
As you said, the clock is now ticking.
On the Cuban side, absolutely.
This is the last chapter of the first book of Reestablishing Diplomatic Relations. Maria Elvira Salazar with Mira TV along with us here on the Florida Roundup. Tim Padgett, America's editor, joining us via Skype from a reporting trip in Honduras. You can join the conversation, 800-743-9570. 1-800-743-WLRN. Join us on Twitter and on Facebook. Did you listen? Did you watch the ceremony of the U.S. flag rising again at the U.S. Embassy, now officially in Havana? Our Public Insight Network members, Gregory Pitts from Weston, wrote, "Cuban people are the hardest working, resourceful people I've seen in my life. I saw them use foreign car parts to repair American-made cars that they use as taxis. Giving Cuban people the opportunity to have jobs and a decent wage would be beneficial for both countries." Teresita in Miami wrote us that it will not improve the life of Cubans, but will prove to the Cuban people in the world that Castro is the one who has the embargo on the Cuban people and not this government. Tim Padgett, as Maria Elvira talks about the clock ticking on democratic reforms, human rights improvements, what reasonably should the Cuban American community in South Florida expect to see now that the next chapter in this re-engagement process is underway?
In the short run, probably not much. This is definitely a long-term strategy, and what it is more than anything else is a bet. It's a bet that the bet that we it's a bet that this strategy will be more effective than the one, as we've been saying, we've pursued for the past half century. And I think there are two things that I think the Obama administration feels makes this a good bet, a better bet, for example, than engagement with China or Vietnam would be. One is simple proximity. As Maria Oliveira mentioned, the United States holds this aura for Cubans that no other country does. We're only 90 miles away, and we are the richest economy in the world. We are a talisman for this island, and our chances then of influencing things politically, economically, socially there are so much more robust than they would be, say, for other countries that engage with Cuba, like Canada or Spain, etc. The second factor, I think, is that unlike China and Vietnam, the communist system in Cuba tends to depend much more on the personality cult of the Castros. Those two gentlemen are in their late 80s. Fidel Castro just turned 89 yesterday. Once the Castros and their generation of hardline communist leadership tend, you know, sort of go by the wayside biologically in Cuba, I think the Obama administration feels that there is a better chance that the communist system there will begin to feel a bit of an enervation, a bit of a loss of the energy it had, and that will make it a little easier to help influence democratic and capitalist change there.
In the meantime, the lens of today's ceremony, Maria, did not have dissidents invited to the front lawn of the U.S. Embassy in Havana. Instead, they will be mingling with U.S. diplomats and presumably Cuban government officials at a different kind of reception this afternoon at the home of the leader of the embassy, not the technical ambassador, but the charge there.
De Laurentiis.
De Laurentiis,
that
yeah.
is that that's a very big problem that Kerry tried to finagle, like we would say.
And, he explained it by logistics, saying it was a small space and it was a government-to-government ceremony.
Listen, reality, according to my opinion, is that Obama needed to go through this day, could not bring any type of anger or put into any type of jeopardy having the ceremony go into a peaceful mood. But reality is that the dissidents should have been invited to be part of the embassy opening. But we know that that was not possible because politics is real. Politics is the art of the possible. That's the way politics works. So it was not possible to invite these people, which are the arch enemies of the Cuban brothers. So the compensation candy was to invite them to the ceremony after. That's why Marco Rubio is so upset, and he's been saying it on every single news media that has been interviewing him. And it's true. And then there is, like Jim was saying, it proves to you how difficult this could be, or it will be in the future, for the Obama administration or for any American administration to force and to cajole the Cuban government to open some sort of democratic crack into the wall. And we haven't seen it yet.
You know, Tom, on the other hand, I find it a little ironic that the hardline Cuban-American leadership in the United States has pushed as hard as it has regarding the dissident issue for today, because part of the reason that the Castro regime has been able to stay in power as long as it has is because the dissident movement there has not been as effective as it was, for example, in Eastern Europe back in the 20th century. And frankly, and a lot of Cuban Americans don't want to hear this, but frankly, a big part of the reason for that is because for years and years, the Cuban American leadership here really didn't itself do much to help the dissident movement.
I agree with what you're saying, but I also think we should take into account the fact that the repressive apparatus in Cuba has been very effective, just like it was in Eastern Europe.
Sure.
And we also have to come to the understanding that that big dissident movement never had an outlet to get to the Cuban people. So what you're saying is it could be very true, but you have to include this tiny little factor. Perfect example is Yoani Sanchez. Ioannis is loved and is very is delicious for the international media.
And we should say you're talking about the internationally famous dissident blogger.
That's right, Ioanny Sánchez. Everybody right. knows mm-hmm. her outside of Cuba. Few people know her in Cuba. I would only like to give the opportunity for Ioanny to be known throughout the island, and then we'll then decide if Ioanny really has an appeal to the Cuban people or not.
And supporters of the re-engagement process here will point to the Obama administration's particular specific effort when it comes to internet access as part of their effort to re-engage and push the human rights issue, to push civil society, to push democracy, to your point of Ioanny Sánchez
threat.
Not being known within her home country because of the lack of internet penetration.
Cuba has the lowest internet penetration in the Americas, less than 10%. And that's why when Google offered the Castro brothers, we're going to give it to you for free. We're going to wire and put all the cables and the antennas. You don't have to pay me for anything. They said, oh, no. The CIA is behind this thing.
Ioanny Sánchez herself has written that we have to have a broader view of what the dissident movement is in Cuba. She herself wrote last year in the New York Times that every time a Cuban opens up an independent enterprise, an independent business in Cuba, it's one more step toward undermining the communist authority on the island. So I think this is also the Obama administration's, from what I can tell, a bet on this as well, is that we have to start thinking of the dissident movement in economic as well as political terms.
Let me ask both of you, though, about some of the realpolitik that was happening elsewhere in Latin America this month. In Bolivia, the president of Bolivia, who's had a troubled relationship with the United States, in 2008, that country expelled the U.S. ambassador. United States responded doing the same to the Bolivian ambassador. Just this week, President Evo Morales of Bolivia announced that it would resume good relations with the United States. Clearly, this is being overshadowed with today's ceremony in Havana, clearly for this community. But Tim, put this in perspective. When we see the Stars and Stripes again in Havana today, 54 years after the fact, we see Bolivia essentially reaching out, and the United States reaching out to Bolivia in a way that hasn't happened in the better part of 8 years.
More significant is what's going on right now between the United States and Venezuela.
Right.
You're seeing Venezuela start to soften its approach to the United States because it is seeing that it has, because of what's going on with Cuba, it is sort of defanged the whole anti-American enthusiasm that they are constantly trying to build among their own populations. When you see the United States now peacefully re-engaging with Cuba, it lessens this argument that they can make that Latin America, especially leftist governments like Venezuela and Bolivia, are under siege by the United States. And I think the Obama administration can point to as what you're talking about with Bolivia and particularly with Venezuela as proof that this step to reengage with Cuba is going to have a very significant ripple effect diplomatically across the region.
Absolutely, because once the big mentor was Fidel Castro, his brother Raul has decided to shake hands with Obama. It's very difficult for President Maduro and President Ortega and President Morales to say that the Yankees are the bad guys.
So this re-engagement relationship between the United States and some of these Latin American countries, still very young, in some cases
but it's bringing
just
big dividends.
Old, but the Obama administration is growing gray. It is
a
lame duck administration.
No.
How much of these new relations can withstand the 2016 political cycle in the United States, Maria?
I think that what Obama is doing is irreversible, and the Republicans know it, and the Democrats know it.
It's irreversible.
Irreversible. That cannot be turned. The clock cannot be turned back. I think that the next thing is going to happen is that the economic embargo is going to be lifted, not within the next 2 years, because I'm sure that the Republican Senate and House of Representatives of the Republican Congress is not going to allow that to happen, having Marco and having Bob Menendez and having Ileana and all the representatives.
Well,
chances are that after the presidential elections in 2016, we do not know what's going to be the composition of the new Congress, federal Congress. Everything indicates that embargo will be lifted. Now, that will happen according to what the Cuban government does when it comes to a business opening or political engagement with the civil society.
Well, for a long time, as we led up to today's ceremony of raising the flag, Cubans pointed to its inclusion on the list of state sponsors of terrorism as a real stopping point for the re-engagement. Cuba was taken off that State Department list in May. Here we are in August. The flag flies again. Cuba now pointing to the embargo. The United States perhaps leveraging, Tim, its ability to go toward the embargo. But we heard Secretary Kerry say unequivocally they want the embargo lifted and acknowledging that it would take an act of Congress to do it.
Right. And I don't see the embargo being lifted while Obama is president, frankly. What I do see happening, perhaps, is that the travel ban for Americans traveling to Cuba as tourists will be lifted. Yeah. I think that'll be sort of a litmus test to see what can get through Congress. And then when Obama's gone, I think in the next administration, we will see, if this kind of momentum keeps going, I think we will see the embargo lifted soon into the next presidential administration.
That's Tim Padgett, our America's editor here at WLRN. Maria Elvira Salazar with Mira TV, along with me, Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup. Now, while the Obama administration is celebrating today this new chapter in relations with Cuba, another Caribbean neighbor continues its long struggle with democracy. After almost a four-year delay, Haiti held legislative elections on Sunday. Almost 2,000 candidates were on the ballots to fill fewer than 150 seats in parliament. Results are not expected until next week. Tim, these elections come after parliament was dissolved 8 months ago. What's at stake?
Well, what's at stake is, as I've written for WLRN.org recently, what's at stake is fostering better leadership in Haiti. It's amazing. We have not seen parliamentary elections in Haiti for about 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. These elections should have been held 4 years ago, but because of this confrontation between a fairly authoritarian President Michel Martelly and his dysfunctional opposition, these elections were never held. And so we've had Congress shut down. In fact, you don't have a legislative body functioning in Haiti for most of this entire year.
The argument's been it's not only been a one-party rule, it's been a one-person rule.
It's been he's been ruling by decree. So right. What you have, you know, look, in any democracy, elections are the furnaces where new leadership is forged. So look, Haiti, these elections we had last Sunday were a mess in many ways, but I still feel they were better than no elections at all. And it helps to put Haiti back on democratic track so that it can then start emerging from this horrible 2010 earthquake.
And it continues, obviously, to see challenges in its economy, challenges in its society, in its communities, and, of course, even within its politics because of that natural disaster. Maria, what are the lessons for South Florida and its long history, obviously, with Haiti and some of the political challenges it's seen on that island and the diaspora here and its engagement and its effort to get high-level engagement on the part of U.S. officials into that country?
I think you can create a parallel between Haiti and Cuba. Haitians, they are hardworking, nonviolent people that abide by the law. They're God-fearing, law-abiding people. And it proves it when they get to South Florida. Cubans, when they come to South Florida, they try to abide, not all the time, they try to abide by the law and they try to become and to create the American dream for their kids. So Haitians in South Florida, they have this well of resources that could go back, and they try to go back to their country and create what they've created here, created there. The big problem, as Tim was saying, is the political class. Mm-hmm. The political elite in Haiti is something that we really do not have a word to. We cannot say it on the air. And unfortunately, Haitians do not deserve it, just like some Cubans do not deserve the leadership that we've had in this last century.
Maria Elvira Salazar with Mira TV with us here on the Florida Roundup. Thank you for your thoughts.
My pleasure to be here.
Tim Padgett reporting via Skype from Honduras here on this historic day with Cuban-American relations. Tim, always appreciate your insights as well.
Thanks, Tom.
Still to come here on the Florida Roundup, stick around. We go local with Broward commissioners. They're ready to loosen some rules to bring ride-sharing service Uber back to Broward County. That's next. We're back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Could Uber be back in Broward soon? Well, Broward commissioners have been under pressure by its residents and riders to find a way to bring back the ride-sharing service Uber and others to the county. Now, Uber and competitor Lyft left Broward at the end of July. They didn't want to play by the rules the Broward Commission initially approved, including fingerprint background checks and commercial insurance. Now, it was a full house in the chambers on Tuesday when commissioners voted 6-2 to begin drafting looser regulations in hopes of bringing Uber back to Broward. Broward County Commissioner voted against loosening the rules, saying the regulations to protect Uber drivers and passengers alike.
Uber drivers, I hate to tell you, but you can be personally sued and you can be liable for that. And that is what the county commission is trying to prevent.
Now, Commissioner Stacey Ritter proposed setting up a taxi accountability program, which would allow customers to rate taxis, much like Uber riders rate their drivers. And that is likely to get a future vote.
We're a tourist-based county. And when people come to this county and receive unsatisfactory service from the taxi industry, it reflects poorly on all of us here in Broward County.
Okay, Uber drivers and riders, are you willing to ride and drive with fewer regulations? What about the politics of this sharing economy and light regulation? Let us know. 800-743-9576. Uber back on the Florida Roundup yet again. 800-743-WLRN. Send us a tweet at WLRN and on Facebook, facebook.com/group/TheFloridaRoundup. Mike Mayo with the Sun Sentinel is back with us here on the Roundup. Nice to see you, Michael.
Good to see you, Tom.
Brittany Wallman covering Broward County Hall for the Sun Sentinel joining us via Skype. Brittany, welcome back.
Hi, thank you.
And Commissioner Mark Bogan, Broward County Commissioner, is on the telephone. Commissioner Bogan, thanks so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Tom.
Brittany, let's start with kind of where things are right now for the commission. Last we had left it prior to this week, the commission was approving regulations that would require level two background checks, fingerprinting for Uber drivers. It would require car inspections for Uber drivers. It would require a certain level of insurance for Uber drivers. What happened this week?
Well, basically, a majority is now embracing more of a self-regulation model, which is what Uber is insisting on. So what won't be in the regulations will be drivers won't have to get a county chauffeur registration. They won't have to submit fingerprints. They won't have to get a county background check. The county won't know their names, won't have their driving and criminal histories on file. They won't have to show proof of commercial insurance. And the county is going to give Uber a little bit of time to get insurance requirements amended in the Florida legislature.
Commissioner Bogan, did you roll over on Uber?
Well, you know, that's what the people in the taxi industry are saying. But, you know, after we passed our regulations requiring all these different things, the public and even the Sun Sentinel editorial board wrote, you know, that we should be listening to our constituents. And so I took it literally, and I did an 18,000-piece mail-out to my constituents in District 2. And even though I voted for the more stricter, I think my job as an elected official is to listen to my constituents. I agree with the Sun Sentinel. Listen to your constituents. And I think that's our job. And our job, and the majority of our constituents, and I think throughout Broward County, want Uber and want not a lesser regulation. I think you said at the beginning of your program, a light regulation. It's the same. We're doing a background check. We've done a background check for 40 years on taxi, limo drivers, van drivers. We're just not increasing it. That's all. So nothing's changed. Nothing as far as background checks are changing, except we're requiring more stringent background checks from Uber than the county has done before.
But you won't be, the county, to interject, the county won't be doing the background checks anymore. That's an option, but it gives Uber and other companies, including taxis, the option to do the background checks themselves. So in that scenario,
right,
if you were wronged by a taxi driver today, you can go to the county, pull the history, find out the person's name and what his driving and criminal history was. That will no longer be the case.
Right. And in the same example given by Brittany, if you were wronged by an Uber driver, the county has the right to audit and go into the records and to pull that as well. That's something that we'll be able to do in the county.
Commissioner Bogan, this is Mike Mayo here. To go in and do an audit of what? Do you get to find out the driver's name?
We have the ability to go. The regulations that I proposed is that we have the ability to spot audit any of their records. The records will
But what does that mean in English? Can you find out the full name of the driver and find out what his background is?
Uber has said that its drivers are not employees, that they're essentially freelance contractors. So are there records to audit?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. But a simple yes or no to my question. Can you find out the full name of the person through this spot auditing?
I would believe that the information that would be there that we do an audit of
All right. Let me just jump in with an overview here. I'm sorry.
I'm just curious, Mike. Let me ask you here with the commissioner's proposal of lighter regulation than the commissioner originally approved. Will Uber riders, presumably, if Uber comes back to Broward, will they be as secure under these new proposed regulations as they could have been under the previous regulations?
The simple answer is no, but it's in a bigger context of people don't feel especially safe or secure going to taxis either. Let's back up here. What we saw this week in Broward was a complete and utter capitulation to Uber after what they enacted and how Uber reacted and pulled out. And look, it's popular. People love it. It's a great service. We all agree on that. It's just a matter of Uber was able to basically play the three South Florida counties off against each other beautifully, where they were still able to operate in the other two. Broward was the first to act and allow them to operate, but within a tighter regulatory framework. Uber pulled the fit, and then what we saw is just a complete, you know, obviously public rebellion that they want this, but I'm still a little bit, it's in one way, it's great because, as Commissioner Bogan said, the public, you know, the actual public servants listen to the constituents, and that's how it's supposed to work. But in the other way, it's a little bit scary the way that Uber is able to just come in, disregard all established rules and regulations, and through kind of a mob herd mentality of marshaling their supporters through social media and a bombardment through email and other means, get what they want.
Commissioner Bogan, do you feel bullied by Uber?
Well, you know, Mike has a point. I partly agree with him and I partly disagree. First of all, you know, Uber did come in. They had this petition supposedly signed by, I heard, 80,000 people and trying to, you know, and their PR was, you know, trying to, you know, persuade the commissioners in any way they could. And that's why I thought it was important. I didn't know who was signing that petition. I don't know if there are people that live in Connecticut, New York, or here down locally. And so, you know, and again, what Mike said, I agree with. The people want it. Forget Uber being a bully, not being a bully, the taxi cab industry. It's all irrelevant. It's what do our constituents want? As an elected official, I'm a lawyer. I represent clients. As an elected official, I think as long as it's legal and as long as there's a safety component, which there is, I think you have to listen to your constituents.
But I think that's right, Commissioner. But on the other hand, I would imagine a number of your constituents would like lower property taxes and would like some to pay a lot less for public services. So is that
I'm sure? If the public wanted less service and less tax, I think that we, as an elected official, are obligated to listen to our constituents. And, you know, as long as it's not, you know, if somebody said, well, then if they want you to pass a law legalizing heroin, I mean, that's a little crazy. I think we have a job to do, and the job is to, you know, ensure safety. And there is safety with this. You know, there is a third party that is required to do an enormous amount of background checks on each driver.
Look,
yeah, we may not know the name, but still, the background checks are being done.
Commissioner, let me just ask the same question of you that I just asked Mike Mayo, the Sun Sentinel.
Sure.
Assuming that your proposal for lighter regulation of ride-sharing services is approved by your colleagues at the Broward County Commission, and assuming that Uber and other ride-sharing services turn on their apps again for Broward riders, will those riders be as safe under those proposed regulations as they would have been under the previous regulations?
Safer, and I'll tell you why.
Safer than the previous regulations.
Yeah, safer. And let me explain why riders will be safer. A year ago, the county did a certain amount of background checks on every driver. Under this regulation, we have more requirements. For example, there's going to be a Social Security background check that has never been done before. There's going to be a multi-state background check. I think it's called NatCrim. That has not been done before. The county does a check for every county in Florida. They also check for your last known address, I believe, beyond within the 7 years. So if you came from New York 3 years ago, we'll go and check New York, and we'll check here in Florida. But under the new proposal, what this third-party company does is they look at every address you lived in under your Social Security if it goes back 10 or 15 years, and they will check. So there are a lot more checks. There are two more checks. If Brittany remembers the schematic I gave, while I was speaking on the commission, the county and Uber does the sex offender check.
Yes, I memorize all the schematics.
right.
Yeah, flowcharts, sure. But Commissioner, that's about personal safety. What about financial security here and the question of insurance? The previous regulation had required the Uber drivers in their cars to carry commercial insurance. The new proposed regulations that you're supporting, the way that we understand it, is that requirement for commercial insurance is dropped and allows Uber time to essentially negotiate some kind of statewide legislative insurance remedy.
No. The previous regulation required, and we voted on one thing, we voted that Uber must comply with Florida insurance law. Whatever that insurance law is, they must comply. And in this regulation, we didn't change that.
But to comply as a for-hired car service or to comply as a private driver in a private vehicle? Because my insurance is a lot different as a private individual than if Mike Mayo would have a taxi medallion.
Of course. And they are required to comply with Florida law. So Florida law specifies that they are to have an admitted carrier and they're to have an admitted commercial policy.
Which they don't.
Florida law, whatever Florida law, we did not change that at all.
Right.
We did not change that vote at all.
Basically, the commission is punting on the insurance issue. I mean, if you operate a for-hire vehicle as a driver, the Florida law, as I understand it, is that you're supposed to have commercial insurance. Completely for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Uber is trying to get into this netherworld of, when they're on the app, they have our umbrella commercial policy, which, by the way, is not from an admitted carrier. That means one that's regulated by the state of Florida. It's an outside carrier. So the bottom line is I'm still confused by the insurance issue. I'm confused about who's driving me. If what gets me about Uber, first of all, forget this ride-sharing business, and I see, Tom, that you've bought into the ride-sharing nomenclature. This is not ride-sharing. This is ride-brokering. My colleague calls it ride-hailing service. But they are arranging a transaction for money, for profit, between a willing buyer, rider, and a willing driver. That is not sharing. Sharing is when I go to the Heat game with my neighbor. So I hate that, but this is part of their whole propaganda, which has been very effective.
But part of that Heat game, though, is you probably buy dinner and a couple of beers
part of sharing,
sure.
But it's not a transaction that's done through a credit card. And number two is just the hypocrisy of Uber is like, we can't find out who their drivers are because that's proprietary. But you try signing up on their app by just giving them your first name and maybe a fake first name and a credit card number. They won't let you do it.
Brittany Wallman, covering Broward County Hall for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Let me ask you about kind of Uber's response to this, which has not been a full-throated endorsement of Commissioner Bogan and his efforts for lighter regulation, has it?
No, there was a model that they wanted the county to adopt, and that was what the city of Tallahassee had adopted. It was a lot of self-regulation for Uber. What Uber's afraid of in Broward is, they heard what they heard at the meeting. It sounded good. It sounded like a majority, a 5-4 majority, is going to pass whatever it takes to bring Uber back so that people will stop harassing them with emails. But what they're afraid of is what's going to be in the law when it comes back. They just want to see, last time there were things that came back in the actual law that were put in there by the county attorney, like list the VIN number of every single vehicle that's under your license. They want to see it in black and white.
Yeah.
They bring all their drivers back.
Yeah, Uber is very much an aggressive company when it comes to its own business interests, but in this case, it's being very conservative and withholding any kind of endorsement. Let's go to the phones here, and Henry is joining the Florida Rondo from Boca Raton. Go ahead, Henry.
Yes, how you doing? My name is Henry. I have a website, bocadriver.com, and basically my company, we use all licensed and commercially insured drivers with Palm Beach County. We all have our license. And what no one's really mentioning is you talk about constituents and people who live in the community. Thousands of small business owners like myself have just been completely thrown under the bus by the commission. I mean, here we are. We jump through hoops to build these businesses up. We have to get this expensive commercial insurance, $5,000 a year plus. We get permits for all the airports, and we do all our best. We go through background checks with Palm Beach County, and now all of a sudden, you know, a company comes in, it uses its muscle, and the commission caves in a second, and now we're all stuck, basically. Mm-hmm. They don't have to do the same expenses that we have to come up with. So,
Henry, let me put that to Commissioner Bogan in Broward County. How about that? Are you wind up creating two regulatory systems where one is heavily regulated and thus more heavily taxed, essentially, than another?
No, and I'll tell you why. Because once, if we pass what we have in place, it applies to companies like Henry's. It applies to everybody. We don't say, oh, Uber, you can do this, and everybody else has to do that.
Why would Henry continue in business as his limo service and instead just drop the service and become an Uber driver, though? It would be cheaper for him, wouldn't it?
I don't know that. All I can tell you is that the same regulations apply and will apply across the board. So, you know, we're looking to have an even playing field. We're not looking to carve out something for the TNC, you know, for Uber.
What about the taxi medallions in this regard, Commissioner? Because the taxi medallions, which are highly regulated, there's a limited number of them. They're sold through an auction system. They come with an expense. Those taxi medallions are dropping in value as Uber continues to sign up drivers that don't need those medallions to provide arguably the same service.
So what? I don't understand what you're asking me.
So the point is, the taxi drivers have invested a lot of capital in the medallions and in the insurance, and the Uber drivers are able to operate in the same market without those costs and those regulations under this kind of this dual system between medallions and ride sharing services, or as Mike Mayo calls them, ride brokering services.
The taxi industry has been in my office many times, and I've said to them, do you want to be deregulated? What can we do to enhance your business? What can the county do? They want to be, so far, they want to be regulated. They want to have their own regulations. So as a commissioner, if the taxi industry felt that our regulations were hurting their business and we need to do something, I'd be responsive to it. I think the public needs to know, and to answer your question, the taxi industry wants those regulations.
Commissioner Mark Bogan, Broward County Commissioner here on the Florida Round. Thanks for your time, sir. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
All right. Brittany Wallman covering Broward County Hall for the South Florida Sun Sentinel, and Mike Mayo with the South Florida Sun Sentinel as well. We got to say goodbye to Brittany, but Mayo, you're going to stick around. I know we got plenty more to come. We're going to be talking about the Chinese import, FLACA, the drug in South Florida. That's coming up next here on the Florida Roundup. We're back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Alpha PVP. It's a synthetic stimulant developed back in the 1960s, but today it's better known as FLACA. The epicenter of this drug is Broward County. Hundreds of cases have turned up in Broward over the past year, and this summer, the county's largest hospital system was seeing up to 20 emergencies a day. It's cheap. It acts very fast on its users, and it's only recently been made illegal. In fact, WLRN contacted a Chinese pharmaceutical company to ask how easily Americans can order the chemical. An automated response offered a quote-unquote test sample of 5 grams of alpha PVP for $120. We did not order anything. We were simply inquiring how easy it would be for an American to order this, but the speedy response speaks to the availability of the drug online. Our guests include Robert Hutchinson, Deputy Special Agent in Charge for Homeland Security Investigations in Miami, and South Florida Sun Sentinel columnist Mike Mayo. Agent Hutchinson, how big is FLACA in South Florida?
It's big and it's growing, unfortunately. We are putting a fair amount of resources to it because the ease of importation of smuggling into the United States and the impact of it is really is concerning many of us, federal, state, local, public health, really all areas.
I want to read to you the email response we got from this Chinese company. It said, we do not sell products of questionable quality and we'll never do that. It talks about the qualitative examples of its samples. But then it goes on to say, quote, we have prepared a program of cooperation for new customers. Sending a free sample, it will set the first step of cooperation to check the quality and obtain mutual trust. Again, we did not order any. We simply inquired as to the ease of ordering. Does this surprise you at all?
Well, first, I'm very happy you didn't order it. Thank you. It'll save us a little work. But no, it doesn't surprise us. It's terribly easy to get. I'm not going to speak too much to that because I'm not trying to expand people gathering access and information.
But why is this? I mean, this was a drug that technically wasn't illegal under federal drug laws until spring of 2014, that temporary illegality is due to expire in the spring of 2016.
Right. Really what has happened is you're getting it from nations where the product is not illegal, it's really not regulated, and it's terribly frightening what may be in it. And it was only added as a Schedule 1 drug, as you know, in February of 2014. I'm sure the laws will change to make things more permanent, but we are constantly changing or following and chasing the changing chemicals.
This is Mike Mayo here, but look, this is very scary stuff based on, you know, everything that we've heard and all the people I've spoken to who run the Broward Addiction Recovery Center. It reminds me of back like the Angel Dust PCP days of the mid-70s, where people a lot of times would do it unwittingly, where it was laced in other drugs, whether it's marijuana or something, cut other drugs to make it cheaper. And it has these horrendous effects. It overstimulates the body. It overheats the body. That's why people tear their clothes off. And one of the things is, you know, why are people doing it? Well, and why is Broward such a center? I think it's because, A, we used to be the pill mill capital, and that's gotten cleaned up and clamped down on. So, again, all these people who are prone to addiction end up gravitating to whatever the next thing is that becomes cheap and available.
Special Agent Hutchinson, I want to ask you about that, because Mike Mayo makes reference to the pill mills of 2005, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, when OxyContin was readily available with the kind of forged prescriptions or phony docs. In part, Broward was the center of that because of the prescriptions that were being delivered, and then people coming down I-95 from other locations to get it. Are you seeing that same kind of re-importation, redistribution of FLACA? It comes in internationally into Broward County and then gets redistributed to the United States?
Well, there really seems to be different clientele that are going after this. We're watching this following the different versions of Molly, ecstasy, and there is a natural evolution of these synthetics coming in. When we finally get them scheduled, they're illegal, they will evolve, they're evolving, evolving. And really, we're with Alpha, we're watching it just kind of as the newest drug that's following both methadone and ethylone.
Does it come in as a finished product? Is it come in ready to be used and abused?
Yes, it comes in as a very dangerous chemical that it is. Now, what it's cut with and how it's ingested can even make it worse. If you're going to smoke it, you're going to ingest it, you're going to swallow it. Shoot it, but it is coming in pretty much its complete form. And what's so scary is you don't know who's making it. You don't know what's in it.
And how is it being imported in the United States? I asked that question, Agent Hutchinson, because presumably it's not coming in on private boats from the Caribbean, through the Caribbean, from Latin American countries. This is stuff that usually comes in from Asia via what, cargo ship or air cargo?
Well, it's very easy to import. There's a lot of cargo coming in from Asia, obviously, and there's a lot of things coming through various forms of air cargo, mail, things like that. And it's rather small amounts that can be concealed with other items or mislabeled. And you kind of get lost in a lot of trade.
It's like finding the needle in the haystack, so to speak, right?
Yes, it can be very hard to find. We are working it. We're working very hard with Customs and Border Protection at the border. We work very hard with DEA and state and locals once it gets in. And we're able to seize a lot of it, but unfortunately, it's becoming all too popular, and we're really trying to get ahead of the power curve here because this wave is building.
And the other scary thing about this that the counselors are saying is that the lasting impact, like you might come down from your flock of high, but you might have permanent damage, and they're seeing lingering effects, depression, even kind of schizophrenic symptoms that can flare up for months or years. And so this might permanently alter brain chemistry. This is really, really scary stuff. And
true.
A lot of people are saying it's uncharted territory in terms of some substance abuse.
Synthetic chemical, certainly imported from China here into South Florida. Mike Mayo, columnist with the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Agent Hutchinson, thank you for your time as well. Robert C. Hutchinson, along with us, who is the Deputy Special Agent in Charge for Homeland Security Investigations for the Department of Homeland Security. Finally, on the roundup here today, part of Miami on the Malecone. We've got Richard Blanco, now known as the poet who read at President Obama's second inauguration. But before he became an internationally recognized poet, he was a Cuban-American kid here in Miami. He recited a poem this morning at the ceremony raising the American flag at the U.S. Embassy in Havana. Here's a portion of the poem entitled Matters of the Sea.
No one is the other to the other to the sea. Whether on hemmed island or vast continent, remember our grandfathers, their hands dug deep into red or brown earth, planting maple or mango trees that outlived them. Our grandmothers, counting years while dusting photos of their wedding days, those brittle family faces still alive on our dressers now. Our mothers teaching us how to read in Spanish or English, how to tie our shoes, how to gather false colors or bite into a guava. Our fathers, worn by the weight of clouds, clocking in at factories or cutting sugarcane to earn a new life for us.
Bishop Blanco reading his poem Matters of the Sea at the U.S. Embassy in